and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Jessica Levinson, an associate clinical professor at Loyola Law School, and I'll be filling in for Ian Masters today. Today we're covering topics related to politics and political reform in California from three different perspectives. First, we'll hear from Anne Ravel, chairwoman of the Fair Political Practices Commission. Chair Ravel will give us the perspective on political reform from the head of a government watchdog agency that's charged with creating and enforcing regulations of elections and political activities in California. Second, we'll hear from Kathy Fung, the executive director of California Common Cause. Ms. Fung will give us the perspective of someone working for reform from outside of the government by leading a nonprofit good government group. Third, we'll hear from Tori Van Oot, who covers politics for the Sacramento Bee. Ms. Van Oot closely covered local, state, and federal campaigns this election cycle. She'll give us the perspective of a news reporter who lives and works in the state's capital. So our first guest is Chair of the Fair Political Practices Commission, Anne Ravel. She was appointed by Governor Brown in March of 2011. Most of her career was as an attorney in the Santa Clara County Council's office. Ultimately, she served as the appointed county council from 1998 until 2009. Chair Ravel, welcome. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So you've been leading the state's watchdog agency for more than a year now, and I want to talk about your experience, but I want to start off with talking about the reason you just made news, which is just days before the election, you found yourself arguing in front of the California Supreme Court. Could you explain how you got there and what that case was about?
Yes, I have to say this was quite possibly the most dramatic event of my entire legal career. The FPPC received a complaint a few weeks before the election about an $11 million contribution that was given to a PAC in California, which was funding advertisements relating to Prop 30 and 32 on the November ballot. The contribution was from an Arizona group called Americans for Responsible Leadership. They had never contributed a cent in California before, and the previous contributions that they had made in Arizona were a few and relatively small compared to the $11 million. This was the largest anonymous in the sense of we didn't know who the actual donors were, the actual people, contribution that had ever occurred in California history, but through an independent expenditure. So we contacted the attorney who was listed for the group to ask for documents concerning the contribution and who the donors were. After many days of stalling, we decided to file suit for injunctive relief, requiring them to submit to an audit by the FPPC and turn over documents that related to the contributions. The Superior Court in Sacramento granted our injunction, saying that not having them submit to the audit would be a great harm to the public in not learning the information about who the donors are before the election. So the Arizona group then appealed to the state appellate court in Sacramento asking for a stay, which was granted on the Friday before the election. We knew that a stay would eliminate our possibility of ever getting the information about the true donors prior to the election, which was crucial because getting this kind of information after an election has so much less value to the public. So we filed a petition with the California Supreme Court asking to overturn the stay and to permit the FPPC to conduct the audit. The court gave us, and we filed right away on Friday, the court gave us a briefing schedule that required the Arizona group to file opposition to our request by 5 o'clock on Saturday, and our reply would be due at noon on Sunday prior to the election. I knew that as the Arizona people were delaying everything as much as possible, they would file at 5, which they did at exactly 5. But we stayed up throughout the night, filed our reply with the California Supreme Court at about 2:15 a.m., and in a very unusual 7-0 decision on Sunday at about 2 o'clock, the court ordered that the Arizona group had to turn over their documents to the FPPC at 4. A little after 4, the Arizona group filed a request with the United States Supreme Court saying that they wanted a stay of the California Supreme Court decision, and they sent a letter to the California Supreme Court asking also for a stay in order to appeal to the United States Supreme Court. The California Supreme Court at around 5 said, no, there is no stay, and turn over the documents pretty much, although it was after the 4 o'clock time period.
So what were in those documents that were ultimately disclosed?
Well, that was very interesting because after they determined that the United States Supreme Court was probably not going to act in time, and they were already in contempt of the California Supreme Court's order, they called us and asked if it, and began in negotiations, essentially. They indicated that they were unable to provide all the documents, and what they would agree to do rather than submit to an audit. And by the way, our staff was standing by Sunday night ready to start auditing their documents. But they agreed instead that by 8 a.m. the next morning, Monday morning, they would disclose the names of the donors.
So and what did the public ultimately get as a result of that disclosure?
What the public ultimately got, unfortunately, was two other nonprofit corporations that had given the money, and in fact had given the money in kind of a seriatim way, one to the other, and then ultimately to ARL, the Arizona group.
So it sounds.
But the important thing that they learned and that we learned was that ARL admitted to having been just a shell, that they were not the actual donor. They were essentially laundering the money on behalf of other organizations.
So it sounds like, as you said, that what the ARL situation showed us is that there are a lot of problems with our current disclosure system, and ARL, if it exposed anything, exposed this shell game of individuals giving to corporations and then corporations giving to other corporations. And then what the public ultimately sees is not an individual behind the spending, but a nonprofit group. So what are the greatest problems facing our disclosure system now, and what can we do? As you said, this is important information for the public to receive before an election so that we have information about who's supporting our ballot measures and candidates.
Well, you've said it quite correctly. I mean, the greatest problem today involves these so-called social welfare groups that are tax-exempt, but they can spend money without being subject to disclosure rules, at least not on the federal level. They can't. They're supposed to be dedicated to advancing broad community interests and are technically not political organizations, but they are not really being checked by the IRS because they can spend money and begin fundraising even before the IRS recognizes them as whether as a 501c4. So they basically just send money from one group to another group and then to another group, and then they go out of existence. And it's very difficult to track who's actually the human donor at the beginning of the chain and where the money has gone.
So you're the head of California's watchdog agency. What can we do about this? How can we ensure that we do get this information to the voters before the elections and that the information they receive isn't just a series of corporate donors and spenders?
Well, California does have some requirements for disclosure of donors, which was what we were basing our allegations against ARL on. But they're definitely not stringent enough. We believe, and we're going to be seeking legislation, that it's necessary to require such groups to disclose their real donors. And one way to do that would be to look at certain factors, including if a contribution is over a certain threshold amount, and to make sure that organizations that exist in other states are bound by California law. But also, we clearly need to have greater ability to enforce our rules because, and in particular, prior to an election, we have to make sure that organizations such as these, who are extremely well-funded, our ARL group had lawyers in Washington, D.C. who were representing them. We need to make sure that we can stop them from delaying compliance with California law.
So I want to stay on this theme of disclosure for a second because I think it's such an important one. And as you said, we need to do something to pierce the corporate veil and give the public information about who's supporting what and who they're voting on. One of your previous proposals dealt with asking bloggers who are paid by campaigns to disclose that fact. And I wanted to talk about why the public has a right to know this information. I mean, if the information is out there, isn't it for the public to evaluate the veracity of the blogger's claims and really to see for themselves whether or not they support those claims?
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, to kind of set the stage about bloggers, I've seen numerous studies, primarily by the Pew Center for the Press, that indicate that most people now get political information on the internet. They're getting information in tweets, but primarily in blogs. And so the way that people are formulating their political opinions is coming from bloggers. And this is probably kind of a silly way of saying it, but it occurred to me when I was looking for a face cream to make me look younger and more beautiful, and I looked online and saw a number of people who were touting a variety of different products, and it appeared to be a blog. It absolutely did. It just seemed like your regular person who's just blogging. But then I read, and I've found out since by looking at the Federal Trade Commission's advisories, that a lot of these people are actually paid for espousing these great opinions about these skin creams that are going to make me look 30 years younger.
So this is the advertisement that's supposed to look like a news story, and it's
right.
Actually not.
Exactly. And it is, as far as I'm concerned, it's essential to democracy for people to know if someone is being paid by a campaign to promulgate an endorsement or a view. So people can factor that information in to any assessment that they make of the value to them of the information or the view. People uniformly say that those kinds of pieces of information about how seriously they could take a view is very significant to them.
Well, it seems to me that's why we have television commercials that say the spokesperson is paid for, because we need to know it's not a doctor, it's an actor who put on a doctor's coat, and we'll evaluate that message differently.
Precisely.
And you mentioned something that I think is so important, which is that the public has a right to know this information, and it brings us to something else I wanted to talk about, which is civic engagement. And I know that this is one of the areas that you've focused a lot of time on recently. And I know that you see your role as chairperson of the Fair Political Practices Commission as increasing civic engagement and public confidence. One of your original proposals was to allow people to donate via text message. Could you walk us through how that would increase civic engagement and whether that happened and worked in the most recent elections?
Mm-hmm. Many people feel that one of the problems in elections is that there is an enormous amount of money that is being spent in the campaigns, and that it is primarily funded by wealthy people. And there seems to be an increased view or assumption that large donors have all the access, and that a person who is just a grassroots kind of donor doesn't have any impact, and therefore a number of people believe that if only the wealthy have access, it kind of jeopardizes their willingness to take part in democratic governance. And that, I think, is really a problem when people feel disaffected from the political system. When you look at what happened when people contributed to the earthquake in Haiti and some of the other major relief efforts, it was found that people became very personally involved in those problems, those situations in countries far away, Japan and Haiti and other places also. And they followed it. They tended to be more concerned about it and more interested in it. And so my view was that while the amount of money that might be spent in text messaging might not be as great as what could be spent by wealthy donors, what it will do is engage people and get them more interested in the political issues. They'll get their relatives, their friends interested as well, and they'll follow things and perhaps become more involved.
So what I hear you saying is that even these small donations will essentially allow people to, quote unquote, buy into the electoral process and feel that some sort of investment in their elections and who they ultimately send to their city hall, state capital, or Washington, D.C. I think it's a great idea. I think it's certainly going to be implemented. This actually wraps up our time, so I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences as chair of the Fair Political Practices Commission with us.
Great. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
So we're going to take a brief station break, and after the break, we're going to hear from Kathy Fung. She's the executive director of Common Cause.
It's the money.
If I was in L.A.,
such a widow's day.
Welcome back. This is Background Briefing. I'm Jessica Levinson, filling in for Ian Masters, who's taking a rare and well-deserved vacation. Our second guest is Kathy Fung. She's the executive director of California Common Cause. Her work focuses on election and redistricting reforms, disclosure and transparency laws, campaign finance reforms, and voting rights. Ms. Fung was instrumental in the successful effort to pass initiatives which led to the creation of an independent redistricting commission to draw both state and congressional district lines. Ms. Fung, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jessica.
So you're the executive director of a good government watchdog, California Common Cause. Could you tell us a little bit about this organization and what its charge is?
Sure. It was formed in the 1970s, and it was really a call to action to citizens, regular folks around the country, to try to create an organization that would represent our voices in our halls of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., but also in Sacramento, to give presence to regular people's interests and to counterbalance what we were seeing at the time, which was a lot of special interest influence and a government that was not accountable to people and only accountable to large money interests as well as powerful players that had no accountability to voters or to the public.
Well, it seems like we're continuing to deal with those themes now in 2012. Could you tell us from the reform perspective, what are some of the biggest challenges that someone who's attempting to create political reform in California is facing right now?
You know, I think the biggest issue is just that across the board, there is a general distrust of government. And that, at the same time, I think that there is a desire by the public to have certain services from the public, from the government provided to us. And there's a real kind of disconnect. And I think one of the key things that Common Cause and California Common Cause have really been focused on is how do we rebuild government in a way that it's responsive, that it's accountable, that it's flexible when it needs to be, that it nurtures the best ideas that come out of our citizens, and at the same time is one that people feel a sense of trust in so that we can move forward to do to rebuild our state in our best image possible. I mean, there was a time when people would come to California because we had the best schools and, you know, living here not just because of the weather but the infrastructure and, you know, the housing and the transportation was really the best in the United States. And there's a question about how we can recapture that if it ever existed, but how can we build that kind of a dream again? And that does mean creating a government that people feel reinvested in and a sense of trust in again.
Well, I want to pick up on those themes throughout our discussion, this issue of increasing public confidence and on the other side, this deep distrust that we're seeing of the government that we see on almost every level of the government. And I want to start by talking about redistricting. This was one of your biggest accomplishments, creating for the first time in the state's history an independent redistricting commission that drew the state and federal legislative lines. But I want to ask you, why are we better off, from your perspective, to have a group of unelected citizens to do the very important task of drawing these lines rather than our elected officials who we can hold accountable in the elections?
Right. I think it's important to dissect that question and ask whether or not the question's even correct in some of its assumptions. And in order to do that, you got to go back to how it used to be. In 2001, I was involved in the redistricting process through an organization, the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, and I was organizing communities around the state to look at maps, to see where their neighborhoods and their communities were, and to really try to put together presentations to present to the state legislature how they'd like to see the districts be drawn, in particular to make sure that their communities were not cut into different pieces. And it was a four-month process. There were less than a dozen hearings all told between the Senate and the Assembly. And I think people, you know, coming out of that hearing process, many of them doing it for the very first time, felt excited. And it was only after the hearing process closed and the legislature stopped deliberating in public and went behind closed doors and drew the lines that they really wanted to over the next 2 weeks that people realized the reality, which is that the hearings were a dog and pony show and that the real lines that were going to be drawn would be done as horse trading of neighborhoods and areas in order to protect incumbents. And ultimately, the Democrats and the Republicans did a deal between themselves to ensure that every single incumbent would have a super safe seat and nobody would be dislodged. And what that meant was that if communities along the way had to be sliced and diced into multiple different districts, that was just a sacrificial lamb that people were willing to make because, you know, those votes don't matter anyways. And for the next decade, what we had was districts where the person who was the designated incumbent or the designated successor to that seat essentially had the district rigged for them to win through the rest of the decade. And there were literally only one out of, you know, hundreds of incumbents who ever saw their seat get successfully challenged. And parties didn't switch hands, people didn't have a choice, and I think that that really creates a disconnect between those who are elected and the people who are supposed to be in charge, which is the voters. And so when you say that, you know, have we switched to a system where instead of having electeds draw the lines and assume that electeds can actually be voted out of office if we don't like them, the problem with that assumption is that at least the way that we had it before, because they drew their own lines, they could never be voted out of office. We had some electeds who had been charged with crimes and investigated and literally on their way to, you know, a prison cell, and they could still be reelected because the lines had been drawn in such a way where all of the challengers had been removed from the district and they'd been loaded up with voters who were supportive of that particular incumbent. So we now have a situation where people are seeing already in 2012 a very different electoral landscape, where there are actual choices, where there's competition between elected, sometimes between the same party, sometimes between different parties, and where the outcome is one where a voter's casting a ballot will actually make a difference. And that's where I think it's significant, because if we're going to revitalize our democracy, then your vote has to mean something. It can't be a rigged outcome from the beginning.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing is sort of an inherent conflict of interest with legislatures drawing their own district lines to allow themselves to safely be reelected, but not necessarily with an eye towards keeping communities of interest together. And you mentioned these issues of the importance of a right to vote that matters. And I want to talk about that also with respect to voter suppression laws and voter ID laws. And in this election, I think maybe more than ever, we saw a lot of proposals, voter identification laws, reductions in early voting, and challenges to those laws. And then we found that those laws were declared unconstitutional. And I know that you've worked in the voting rights arena for a long period of time, and I was wondering if you could walk us through what are the legal challenges to those voter ID laws and those laws that reduce early voting?
Right. So around the country, just in the course of 1 year, between 2010 and 2011, we went from two states having voter ID laws to a dozen states successfully introducing and most of those even passing voter ID laws, some of them very stringent. In some cases, you know, there were states like Texas where the kind of voter ID that was required was photo ID, and they would list certain kinds that were acceptable and certain kinds that weren't. And And the ones that were acceptable included, for instance, gun permits, and then unacceptable might be a student ID, even if it was issued by the educational institution. And here we saw courts again and again look at the IDs that were required and ask, have we placed too great of a burden on the voter to securing these IDs, or have we created a discriminatory situation where some kind of ID is preferenced over another, where, you know, in function, we've got the same, we're not necessarily serving the same purpose, right? And in case after case, whether it was Texas or Pennsylvania or Ohio, the courts looked at the ID requirements and said these burdens are too heavy. The state hasn't shown that it's got a plan in place to ensure that everybody can get their ID in time that would be satisfactory, you know, to meet these requirements, and that we wouldn't be essentially disenfranchising people. The problem is that those laws are still on the books. And so it is possible that moving forward, if a state proposes a plan for how they're going to get some type of ID into everybody's hand, even if that ID costs a couple hundred dollars to get, or even if in order to get that ID you have to present, for instance, a birth certificate, which may in and of itself be an expensive or difficult proposition to meet, that those requirements haven't necessarily been struck from the books entirely. Now, around the country, we also saw a concerted effort to roll back other kinds of advances that had made voting much easier. Early voting is one of them. So in many states, the counties were allowed to offer early voting. In some cases, it was sort of 2 weeks before the election or even a month before the election, and people could go into a designated location and be able to receive a ballot and cast a ballot early. And the game that was going on there was it was very motivated by political interests. You know, the people who pushed these laws were politicians who were interested in manipulating the election outcomes. And so they looked to see which populations do I not really want to come out to vote, and how do I make sure that I change the laws in such a way that will impact on lowering that population's turnout. In Florida, the big battle was whether or not they would allow voting on the Saturday and Sunday leading up to elections. And the reason was because a lot of African-American churches had used that Sunday at the pulpit as a, you know, a big motivational sermon and then a time to get people to the polls. And it was thought that that had positively impacted, you know, in turnout on for one party versus another. And so the party in power decided, well, we're not going to have that. We're going to remove the Sunday voting. That happened throughout southern states and the East Coast, and some of those rollbacks were actually challenged. Again and again, there were these kinds of challenges to voting advances that had already been made, or new laws were put into place to create restrictions on voting and voter registration. And the courts almost unanimously pulled back on that, said, you know, you can reduce early voting, but you can't reduce it to the extent that you're going to impact on voter turnout, or you can have some types of voter ID, but you need to provide provisions for everybody to be able to still be able to vote, even if they don't have the correct ID at hand. So you have to give them a fail-safe voting mechanism or something else.
So I want to stay on this theme that's so important of exercising your right to vote, the fundamental right to vote, fundamental because it preserves so many other rights.
Right.
And one of the things that you've done is your position as executive director of California Common Cause. And I know this because you nicely asked me to also volunteer, is to, on election day, work with a nonpartisan election protection group to field calls and protect people's right to vote by working in a call center. Could you describe what some of the most common problems facing voters in California are today? What are some of the most common calls that you got?
Right. So probably over 50% of the calls that we get are people who are either not sure of where they should vote or they're not sure if they're registered to vote. And so a lot of the time it's not an egregious, you know, suppression of the vote that we're helping people through. It's just going online and helping them to look up their information and figuring out, okay, so here's your poll site, and yes, in fact, you are registered to vote, and here's how you need to follow through on that. In some cases, there were people who would call who thought they had registered to vote, but they had showed up to a poll site, and in fact, their name was not in the roster. In which case, what we did was we encouraged them to vote provisionally, because in California, we do have fail-safe voting, and 87% to 90% of all provisional votes do get counted. So that's a good thing. You know, some of the other problems that we saw around California were much more troubling. Some of them included a real rise in poll workers taking it upon themselves to ask voters for ID. Now, we don't know if that is coming from confusion because they heard about it in the news happening in other states, and they somehow transplanted all of that voter ID talk to California, or if these might have been people who had been recruited by this vigilante group called Election Integrity Project to infiltrate into the poll worker volunteer roles and essentially exercise the law, you know, in the way that they saw fit. In some cases, these poll workers would ask everybody for ID. In some cases, they would only ask Latino voters for ID. In either case, as soon as we found out about it through our hotlines or from our poll monitors, we would immediately call the county and have them intervene and correct the situation. But it happened often enough that it was a very troubling pattern. And I think that that's probably the biggest concern that we need to just look out for is this kind of insidious perversion of what the law should be in California to ensure that every voter who shows up actually has the ability to cast a ballot and is not turned away just because of either ignorance or because somebody has taken it upon themselves to pervert the law.
Well, I'd love to talk more about this topic, but I want to wrap up in our remaining about minute and a half with the very important topic that relates to everything we've discussed, which is civic engagement and allowing people of whatever partisan stripe to participate in our representative democracy. And I was wondering, now in our remaining minute, what are some of the steps that you at Common Cause are taking to try and increase public participation in our government?
Well, we're pushing for a lot of laws that I think remove barriers. So some of those examples include the recent passage of the online voter registration law, which immediately allowed 1 million voters to be able to access the system, register to vote, and get engaged. And, you know, a lot of times it's simple things like that. You know, if somebody thinks, hey, I want to get involved, but where do I find that voter registration form? And if they have to go around to libraries or post offices and hunt it down, that creates the bump in the road that may be the reason why they end up not voting ultimately. If they can go online and it's easy because that's how we now do so many other transactions, then why not? And particularly if it's just a matter of getting one system to talk to another, then it's something that also happens to save the state money. Another big change that we're pushing for is same-day registration. And here's where, you know, the kinds of calls that we got in election protection hotlines where people were calling and saying, I know I registered, but I'm just not, you know, they're not finding my name in the roster. That kind of problem could be cured with same-day registration, where if you're eligible to vote and you show up to a designated site, you can still cast a ballot and just register on the spot. The only reason why we have registration deadlines that are 2 weeks in advance is because a long time ago, it took time for us to not only process that information, but literally to carry those the forms.
Physically carry them.
Physically carry them to the sites, right? I mean, I don't want to say horse and buggy, but, you know, it was a long transport period and a long data entry period, and so all of those things took time. We're now in a situation where things can happen much more virtually, and so same-day registration is something where California, you know, really ought to be a leader, not a follower. The lastly is really a challenge to not just removing barriers, but how do we make our elections more vital and interesting to voters? And that means in making and supporting electoral changes that give people choices, so that when you are going to the ballot or even before then, candidates have an incentive to talk to you, and you have an incentive to vote because there's actual choices. And that's where campaign finance changes would remove the imbalance between big money and regular voters are big changes that we're supporting.
Well, Ms. Funk, thank you so much for joining us. We did get to talk in some depth about a number of political reform topics. I wish that we could have talked more about a cause close to my heart, campaign finance reform, but I again want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and what you're working on as Executive Director of California Common Cause. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Jessica.
So we're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll be back with our last guest, Tori Vanute of the Sacramento Bee. Welcome back to Background Briefing. This is Jessica Levinson filling in for Ian Masters. Joining us for our last segment is Tori Vanute. She's a reporter for the Sacramento Bee. She also blogs for the newspaper's website, thesacbee.com. She's covered campaigns, ethics and campaign law issues, political party conventions, the state senate, and the state budget. A little bit of everything. Ms. Vanute, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to dive right in by talking about two changes to California's electoral system that we've just seen play out in the last elections. Redistricting for the first time in the state's history, an independent redistricting commission drew the state and federal legislative lines. And we also have a new open primary top-two election system whereby any voter can vote for any candidate regardless of party affiliation in the primary. And then the top two vote-getters, regardless of party affiliation, proceed to the general election. And from your unique vantage point, covering this from the state's capital, could you tell us how these reforms have played out in the most recent elections?
I think the two biggest takeaways were competition and turnover. And you saw both of those increase both at the state legislative and the congressional level. In terms of turnover, that's kind of something that naturally goes along with redistricting. You've got new lines. This year, as you said, the independent commission drew those lines, so they weren't necessarily thinking about where incumbents, where sitting members already lived. So you had some situations where two members of Congress were in the same district and had to run against one another, or a member that was older, a more senior member, seeing, oh, wow, I've got a really competitive seat for the first time in years, I'm going to step down, creating kind of a free-for-all for that seat. So in that respect, you had a lot more turnover than in the past in our congressional delegation. And in the legislature, it was just massive. I believe 37 members of the state assembly are going to be freshmen, are new to the Capitol. That's almost half of the 80-member body. In terms of competition, that redistricting also did create more competition. The top two primary, one of the effects of that is that we had 28 races where two members of the same party were running on the general election ballot, so two Democrats or two Republicans. In those races, one-third of those races were decided by a margin of 10% or less. So they were very competitive in the races with a Democrat versus a Republican. The more traditional races, the percentage of races determined by that small of a margin more than doubled. So we saw a huge amount of competition in this year's elections.
So that sounds like a significant amount of change. And what I sometimes see as a synonym to competition is expense. And that brings us to another topic that I wanted to talk to you about, which is campaign finance. Competitive races tend to be the most expensive races. This was the most expensive election in our nation's history. The first elections that really took place after Citizens United and the first elections after the rise of super PACs. Could you tell us, based on your reporting, how those developments have changed the elections in California and beyond?
It was a hugely expensive race on the state and congressional levels in California. Fundraising for state legislative and congressional candidates was up as a result, as you said, likely of those more competitive races. And the outside spending was very, very large. You know, on the state level, we have independent expenditures, which, like super PACs, can raise and spend unlimited amounts. 1 week out before the election, spending on state legislative races had exceeded $20 million. And then that number is just expected to rise as the final spending reports trickle in. The number of competitive congressional races in Sacramento alone was home to one of the most expensive races. There was more than, I think it was $8 million spent in the race between Ami Barra, the Democrat who won against incumbent Republican Dan Lundgren. And that $8 million was from outside groups independent of the campaigns, you know, super PACs on both sides of the aisle. And it resulted in voters getting a lot of mostly negative advertising, just bombarded them this cycle. The airwaves in Sacramento, where there were four contested congressional races, you couldn't watch a commercial break without seeing three, four campaign ads all crammed in. So, you know, voters, I think, certainly felt the effects of all of that spending.
Well, I want to talk about something you just brought up, which is that people were kind of bombarded by spending and electioneering communications. And one of the other developments we saw, of course, in this election is the rise of so-called dark money, undisclosed sums that were spent in our campaigns. And I'm wondering how these sums change the way you cover campaigns.
It definitely makes it more difficult. The biggest example, I guess, from this past election was an $11 million contribution made to a committee that wasn't for a certain candidate, but for Proposition 32, a ballot measure that affected unions, a campaign finance measure that affected unions' abilities to raise money for political purposes, and against Prop 30, Governor Brown's initiative. And I'm sure you've talked about this with Chairwoman Ravel in the show earlier, but, you know, as reporters, we have no way to tell our readers or our viewers, if you're on TV or your listeners on the radio, who's behind this message and who's putting a message on the air or who's putting a message in your inboxes can tell you as a voter or as a resident a lot about why they might be saying that, why they might be attacking that candidate, or why they might be supporting the other candidate. So it just makes it more difficult to provide that sort of context and information for our readers.
Well, do you see that changing anytime soon? I know that after Citizens United, there was a good deal of chatter about a Disclose Act. Does it seem like real reform is happening on the state level?
You know, there was some momentum behind a Disclose Act on the state level this past year. I've heard other chatter about initiative potentially targeting some of this spending coming in the, down the pipeline in the next for the next election. And I think we'll just see what the sort of political interest in that or by lawmakers or by other interests that might put that on the ballot would be. You know, I know that for voters, I think super PACs already become kind of a dirty word. So there's a bit of a backlash maybe if you're someone like this nonprofit from Arizona who decided to write that $11 million check. You then have the governor, Jerry Brown, going up and down the state talking about the money, the people behind the mask who won't come out, the shadowy money, and you know, it might have had a little bit of a backlash for that campaign that they were trying to help with that money.
Well, I think so
that could be a result as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. We could see reform via legislation or via public backlash and kind of outcry against certain sums being spent. You mentioned that this money was spent for against ballot measures, and I want to talk briefly about the ballot initiative process because it's hard to overstate its importance, as you know, in California. This last November, we weighed in on no less than 11 ballot initiatives. As you've recently written about, some are already being challenged in court. From your perspective, how does the initiative process affect politics in California?
Well, it definitely has a big impact. I mean, if you have a couple of million dollars at your disposal, you can put a sort of policy on the ballot in front of voters. You can pay someone to gather the signatures, and you can place it on. And one thing we saw this year was several of those measures were had already been proposed through the legislature and had failed to make it through the legislature. One example was within an initiative on cracking down on human trafficking. There is a provision, this is one of the ones that's being challenged, actually, that has to do with registered sex offenders telling law enforcement about their online identities, their email addresses, their social media accounts, that sort of thing. That proposal failed in the legislature, but through the initiative process, it was they were able to get it on, the supporters were able to get it on the ballot. So it creates a really interesting dynamic where, you know, you have different interests pushing for changes or policies through the legislature, and if that might not work, they can go directly to the people. And that's often a very costly option, but it's one that people do choose to pursue.
Well, and as you know, I have an op-ed in your newspaper, the SACB, where I can call for reforms to the initiative process for some of the reasons that you mentioned. It's become very expensive. It's become kind of a shadow government. Do you see any, you know, same question I asked really about disclosure. Is there chatter about really reforming the initiative process? Does it look like it's here to stay in its current form?
I think it's something that would be difficult to do, but it seems like there is some political will for that. Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, the top Senate Democrat, has said even before this election that one of the things he wanted to do in the coming term was propose some changes to the initiative process that includes some sort of sunset for initiatives. One of the criticisms of the process that especially resonates around the Capitol is an initiative that, for example, creates some sort of spending requirement or a funding formula. That's locked in, and the legislature typically can't change that or get around that. So it can create some costs or budget constraints for the state. So Senator Steinberg wants to do a variety of things. He hasn't put it in paper yet in a bill form. It's a little early for that. But things like having a sunset, some sort of, I believe he talked about legislative review or option where if you're proposing an initiative, the legislature had a little bit of a window to tackle that issue first, is something else that's been in talks. So we'll see what happens. There's been other reform proposals as well. I think in one kind of blue ribbon task force had some proposed changes to the initiative process that they could try to put on the ballot separately. Senator Steinberg has a supermajority now in the upper house that he could used to put some of those measures on the ballot in front of people, in front of the people, if he has some reforms that he wants to put to paper.
Well, I know you're going to be covering this closely, and I'll be following you. And one of the things I want to wrap up with in our remaining time together is how people follow you and how this has changed campaigns. It seems to me that you're constantly blogging on SACB.com. You're tweeting on Capitol Alert. How has social media changed the business of covering campaigns?
It makes us have a lot more deadlines.
Right.
Every deadline is 5 minutes ago. As you mentioned, we have our blog. It's SACB/Capitol Alert. It's the Capitol Alert blog. We do at least 2 email blasts a day, and I tweet probably dozens of times a day. And it's a really interesting thing. There's a demand to get the news out first, but from a reporter's perspective, we also want to be accurate. We want to have context, and we want to, you know, make sure that everything we're reporting is a legitimate story, is worthy of the platform we're putting it on. So it's not just, so we don't become just a kind of transcription service rebroadcasting everything that campaigns or candidates or politicians put out in our email inboxes. The thing that I really like about the social media is the engagement. We interact a lot more with sources, with followers, with just political junkies. People are asking us questions during the day, and sometimes it's a question that leads to a really good story. And sometimes people have insights or other tips that we can pick up through that. It's made news gathering and reporting much more of a conversation, a very loud, sometimes disjointed conversation, but a conversation nonetheless.
Well, Ms. Vanute, I know I always enjoy interacting with you on social media and otherwise. I want to thank you very much for joining us and bringing your perspective. It was very helpful for the listeners. So thank you.
Great.
Again.
Well, thanks for having me.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Jessica Levinson, filling in for Ian Masters while he takes a rare and well-deserved vacation. This show is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can find my blogs at paullawtix.lls.edu or follow me on Twitter at LevinsonJessica. Background Briefing will be back tomorrow with more interesting guest hosts for the rest of the week. Bye for now.